state of our camp?
We've mostly managed to secure our position and establish a perimeter, the quartermaster replied. However, we're having trouble procuring lumber to establish proper fortifications, and what little remained of the supplies will not last us long.
What about the supply drops we were supposed to receive via Griffins?
They reportedly met with heavy anti-air fire and were forced to withdraw.
Local procurement efforts, then?
We're still looking into it, Your Lordship. Feeding this many soldiers without pre-prepared rations is no easy task. One that was made even harder given their location on the edge of the clattering plains. The endless fields of tall green grass ahead of them had very little in the way of edible wildlife and vegetation. The forest behind them was another story, but human hunting parties tended to make great targets for the Republic's rangers. It wasn't as if the Eighth didn't have rangers of their own, but their training and skills were focused on archery and warfare, not exploration and sneak attacks. They were soldiers, not adventurers.
I guess we're going to have to wait here until we get reinforced and resupplied, Hayhurst sighed. We're certainly not going to be able to fulfill our original objective without our cavalry.
Probably just what those twigs wanted, Hale spoke up.
That reminds me. I heard your men captured some prisoners.
The commander changed the subject.
Yeah, we got 3 groups of them. 11 in total, Hale confirmed. Although my men were not too happy about it.
Hale's forward scouts had rushed to rejoin the main unit once they'd heard the thunderous roar of that landslide. Though they failed to prevent that masterful ambush, they were nevertheless able to intercept a number of enemy combatants. Some of them tried to fight back and were killed, but those who dropped their weapons in surrender were hastily taken prisoner. It went without saying that the Imperial foot soldiers wanted righteous vengeance for their fallen comrades, but they couldn't just kill the surrendering combatants. Doing so would constitute a war crime in the eyes of Axel, the god of war and combat. The deity was one of honor and duty rather than slaughter and destruction, so he abhorred the merciless killing of those who had lost the will to fight and had admitted defeat. Any soldier who did so would find themselves branded as a heretic, and their side of the conflict would lose favor with Axel. The same applied to those that perpetrated other war crimes, but the killing of prisoners and non-combatants were the main sins that common grunts needed to be wary of. Hayhurst himself didn't complain, as he would have wanted at least some of the Republic's troops captured even without some divine beings meddling.
"Did you manage to get anything useful out of them?" he inquired.
"No, and it's unlikely we will," Hale reported. "They're all simple conscripts without any documents or maps on them. They'd been getting their orders via comm crystals, but those were all broken either before or during their official surrender."
I expected as much.
It was possible to peer into how a comm crystal was used by reading the residual magic imprinted within the crystal due to a commonly known quirk of their design. A skilled enchanter could use those remnants to replay any and all communications used within the last 30 hours or so. It was theoretically possible to eliminate this security risk, but that would reduce the comm crystal's range from a few dozen kilometers to about 20 meters, rendering them effectively pointless.
What about interrogations?
Pointless. There's no way those twigs would tell those grunts more than they need to know. If any of them knew something of value, then they wouldn't let themselves be captured in the first place.
Excuse me, Your Lordship? The quartermaster raised his hand.
What is it, Simmons?
I've heard talk among some of the men about, using the female elves we captured.
Tell them to keep it in their pants. We're not savages.
Savages that would resort to ambushes and poison, then run away from a fair fight?
That was strategy, Simmons, the Baron said sternly. The fact we got done in so completely by a bunch of lowly adventurers merely proves our own failure as officers and soldiers of the Empire.
Although similar on the surface, there was a huge difference in mindset between an adventurer and a soldier. While trained military personnel were generally speaking stronger in a straight-up confrontation, They were not nearly as flexible or adaptable as a skilled adventuring party. The main problem with including both types of people in an army was that of authority, as adventurers actively questioned orders they deemed stupid, suicidal, or both. They also lacked the knowledge and discipline that was crucial to pulling off large-scale tactics and formations. Even if the Republic Force's hillside ambush was effective, their disorderly retreat proved just how difficult it was to coordinate between so many small groups out for themselves. However, the leaders of the 8th Imperial Expeditionary Force had clearly underestimated the creativity and resourcefulness of the Ishigar Republic's adventurers. The one-sided loss they had suffered earlier that day was humbling, to say the least. None of these 6 men were willing to let it happen again.
"Shall I send word to have our superiors send us some consultants, Your Lordship?"
Simmons offered.
"Indeed. Just make sure they triple-check their backgrounds. The last thing I need is for some blasted spy to worm themselves into my regiment. Next, I want to discuss where we go from here."
The setting sun slowly but surely descended beyond the horizon as the post-ambush debriefing carried on. The darkness of night had firmly settled in by the time the meeting was adjourned. Tonight was also cloudy, leaving torches and lamps as the only sources of light within the sea of tents in the Imperial camp. Magical illumination was also present, of course, but that was reserved for lighting up the perimeter beyond the camp's hastily erected guard towers, ramparts, fences, and other fortifications. The fact that the Imperials had managed to set all this up in less than half a day was a testament to their tenacity. Quartermaster Simmons walked out of the command tent, parted ways with the other officers, and made his way over to where the prisoners were kept. A total of 5 steel cages lined up in the open and surrounded by several guards. 2 of the men stationed there greeted the officer with salutes while the others remained vigilant. The quartermaster then informed the soldiers of Lord Hayhurst's decree. The elven prisoners were not to be touched. He then left them to their duties so he could attend to his.
"That's a shame,"
one of the guards grumbled.
"They really are quite the beauties, aren't they?"
He turned around and looked them over. Of the 11 captured prisoners, 6 were female. Although this ratio was nothing special as far as adventurers were concerned, the Imperial Army was overwhelmingly male. In fact, there was not a single woman within this entire 5,000-strong detachment. Even if that weren't the case, it would be doubtful that they'd have the sort of attractive figures that female adventurers seemed to cultivate.
"I'll say," murmured his colleague. "The tall one with the black hair is totally my type, too."
"The abs are a turn-off for me. Much prefer the green-haired one on the right. She's got some commendable mana tanks, if you know what I mean."
Of course, being made prisoner meant the vast majority of their possessions had been taken from them, leaving them in just their undergarments. Not only that, but the fact they had MP-draining collars around their necks and enchanted steel bindings around their wrists and ankles only seemed to fuel certain fantasies. In short, the sight of those women was like spotting an oasis in the middle of a desert from the perspective of the common Imperial soldier.
"Still, that Simmons sure is something to take our joke to the Baron himself."
"I'll say. Gotta be careful what we say around that guy."
The common Imperial soldier also had far too much discipline and decorum to do something as unsightly as forcing themselves on these women just because they felt bitter or pent up. Not only was it amoral, illegal, and unprofessional, but also a potential security risk. Admittedly, such incidents occurred regardless, but they were extremely uncommon and the perpetrators were severely punished by their own superiors. The Ishigar Republic's propaganda stated otherwise, of course. The Elven government spent many decades subtly convincing their citizens that the Empire's military was full of bigoted, warmongering rapists. The underhanded smear campaign had been largely successful, too. Most elves would instantly believe it if someone told them an Imperial soldier had either sexually or violently assaulted them for no reason. Incidentally, this same mentality had also helped a certain shape-shifting box better blend in with elven society.
"It really is a huge shame, though,"
the first guard repeated after a few minutes.
"Hey, come on, you're better than that.
his colleague reminded him.
Easy for you to say. I haven't had a chance to do it in months. And then we got sent out here.
I know. And I feel ya, but you heard Simmons. The elves are not to be touched.
So, it's okay as long as it's not the elves, right?
What?
The guard nodded his head towards the cage at the far end, the one that had only a single occupant in it. It was a red-headed beastkin girl with feline ears and a tail. She had her own cage, since she had made quite the unfavorable impression during the battle. More than a few people could identify her as the culprit responsible for torching most of their supplies with those weird arrows of hers. Her crimson hair and tanned skin stood out immensely, even in the heat of battle.
"You can't be serious,"
the second man exclaimed.
"Why not?"
"She's a prisoner. Also, she's basically still a kid. Not to mention she's a freaking cat."
"Cat is fine, too."
"I can't believe we're even having this conversation.
Have you actually taken a good look at her?"
The sensible one rolled his eyes, but had to admit he hadn't actually done so. He ended up almost unthinkingly staring at her exposed body. Of course, the prisoner could hear them perfectly, and she glared daggers at them while curling up to cover up her features with her hands and knees. That did little to conceal her unearthly charm, however. The guard found himself momentarily captivated by the sight of her slim yet feminine body as the light of the surrounding torches danced around her. Even that unpleasant expression of hers, halfway between fear and disgust, radiated a fierce kind of charm.
"Okay. You might have a point there," he consented after a while.
"Look,"
whispered the other guard.
"We can just take her in for interrogation. Nobody has to know, right? The other lads can all have a turn. It's the least we can do to pay her back for all she'd done earlier."
The other man found his resolve wavering. They'd all had an exceptionally grueling day, and were then unlucky enough to pull guard duty for most of the night. To say he felt stressed out would be an understatement. Not to mention that he couldn't get the image of that near-naked cat girl out of his head, no matter how hard he tried. All these factors made it so that, despite his better judgment, he went along with this clearly immoral plan.
"I guess we wouldn't technically be violating our orders. What about the other lads, though?"
"You're right. I'll go have a chat with them."
The other guards stationed there were then quietly let in on the scheme. There'd be repercussions if they were found out, and it was a clearly stupid idea. Yet they all eventually joined in with a shared promise of keeping what they were about to do a secret between the lads. Sure, the prisoner might say something, but it would be her word against theirs. Thus, in the middle of the night, when they were sure everyone but the perimeter guards were asleep, the two masterminds quietly carried off the heavy cage with the cat girl in it. She had fallen asleep, but woke up when she felt she was being moved. Fearing what was about to happen, she rattled her chains in a blind panic. She opened her mouth in an attempt to scream, but the magic collar on her neck prevented her voice from leaking out. Her resistance was cut short when one of the guards pointed a blade at her throat, sending a very clear message. Just because they couldn't kill her didn't mean they couldn't make her suffer. The redhead broke down and sobbed silently as she was brought inside a small tent in the darker section of the large camp. One of the guards unlocked her cage and started taking off the lower portion of his armor. The other one remained just inside the entrance to the tent as a lookout. He was going to make sure nobody disturbed them while also keeping an eye on the prisoner in case she tried anything stupid. It was thus that the beastkin girl's lower garment was thoughtlessly ripped off as the man forced himself inside her. He was then instantly overwhelmed by a wave of pleasure far greater than anything he'd expected. He would have probably drowned in it if his buddy didn't snap his neck while he was distracted. The seemingly traitorous soldier then took off his glove and transformed his index finger into a key, which he used to unlock and remove the prisoner's bindings.
You said you'd let me have my fun,
the catgirl-shaped succubus complained.
I was really getting into the roleplay, too.
It had been far too long since she'd wringed a man dry, and this raped-while-bound-and-gagged thing greatly appealed to her masochistic tendencies.
I changed my mind, her master replied. We wasted too much time on this part of the plan, so shut up and get ready for phase 3.
Yes, master.
Though the succubus had reservations about this hastily concocted scheme, she had to admit it went off better than she anticipated. It started when Boxy had underestimated the Imperial scouts that chased its team during the messy retreat following the hillside ambush. Realizing that it wouldn't be possible to get all of them out of there without compromising its public persona, the shapeshifter decided to use this opportunity to infiltrate the enemy's ranks. To that end, it had Zira take over its role as Kira without Lola, Jules, or even Puru Pururin noticing. The succubus then used the Beastkin's authority as the team's leader to convince them to surrender before they were caught and killed. While Team 3-1 was being taken into custody, aside from the ivory succubus, who was killed on the spot since Axel's taboo didn't extend to magical servants, Boxy enacted Phase 2 of its plan. It used the broken reflection skill on a random soldier. The man's pilfered memories made Boxy's job a lot easier as it infiltrated the human's ranks and scouted out their camp. From then on, it was a simple matter of finding out where the prisoners were and secretly replacing one of their guards when they went to take a bathroom break. This was when it encountered a minor snag, as it had taken a fair bit of time to separate Kira from the other prisoners in preparation for the next part of the plan. Though it had initially promised Zira she could have her way with the poor sap she enticed into raping her, a succubus's lethal intercourse session could take anywhere from 10 minutes to a half hour. The other men guarding the prisoners would most likely realize something was going on if their colleagues took that long to return. Letting the succubus have her fun simply wasn't worth risking the entire plan. One could argue that Boxy shouldn't have promised her anything to begin with, but it was the sort of argument that would end with someone getting their face bitten off. As for the reason why the juvenile doppelganger went through all this trouble, it was to give Kira a plausible means of escape. Boxy also secretly procured some important-looking documents earlier that afternoon, which it intended to bring back to its commanding officers. All of this would surely make its rookie ranger persona seem like a genuine war hero. Boxy's alter ego would surely receive special treatment and perks from her peers and superiors if this plan succeeded. It would also go a long way towards advancing its doppelganger job progression, which was the whole point of the Kira thing to begin with.
Ah, crap.
The shapeshifter realized something.
What is it, Master?
I can't leave without the other prisoners.
I suppose that's true,
the succubus agreed. Kira Morgana was supposed to be kind-hearted and fiercely loyal to her friends, so having her selfishly escape by herself would be both out of character and quite unheroic. Breaking all of them out of Imperial custody and successfully guiding the group back to base would doubtlessly be incredibly impressive, but also impossible to do without Boxy revealing its true nature. After all, it was not the sort of feat a 16-year-old level 29 ranger could pull off by herself. However, it would be entirely plausible if the harrowing breakout took place while the Empire soldiers had something a lot more important than escaping prisoners to deal with. The shapeshifter's hastily concocted scheme was then replaced by an even less planned-out course of action. Back at the other cages, both the stationed guards and the now-awake prisoners were getting restless, albeit for entirely different reasons. It was not a secret to any of them as to why Kira was carried off, but almost 30 minutes had passed since then. Just as the guards were thinking of doing something about it, they spotted something in the air. Something so surreal that it took them a few crucial moments to process it. Blazing through the night sky was a meteor, a destructive siege-type spell available to mid-level pyromancers. Judging from the size of it, this one held quite a bit of power. Guards and prisoners alike stared in silent shock as the inexplicable thing crashed somewhere into the opposite end of the camp.
Enemy attack!
Someone shouted after the fact. The thunderous roar and gigantic fireball instantly kicked the soldiers' trained bodies into gear. The sounds of battle could be heard in the distance within the next few seconds as the Imperial Army engaged whoever or whatever was attacking their position. The sounds of men screaming, spells exploding, and metal clashing against metal all intensified as more and more awoken soldiers rushed towards the site of the disturbance. The guards watching the prisoners wanted to join, but they couldn't abandon their posts. The possibility of this being a distraction to free the prisoners was high considering the timing involved. It was ludicrous to think that this raid and their two colleagues going missing was unrelated, so they resolved themselves to stay firmly in place unless ordered otherwise. Much to their surprise, they soon realized they didn't need to go to the battle, because the battle came to them. Two towering figures, each of them well over 2 meters tall, made their way through the sea of Imperial soldiers in front of them. One was a four-armed, red-skinned woman that sent grown men flying with each swing of her armored fists. The 2 metallic horns on either side of her wild green hair made it perfectly clear she was a demon. Her well-muscled body was covered in wounds oozing with black blood, yet they didn't seem to slow her down in the slightest. In fact, judging from the ecstatic look on her face, she was having the time of her life. The other figure was a heavy-set man wrapped in a plain brown cloak thoroughly soaked in fresh blood. His face and hair were wrapped in a blue cloth, showing only a pair of yellow eyes glowing slightly from within. He held a sword in each hand and wielded the twin blades with deadly efficiency. Every time he swung, a soldier lost his head amidst a fountain of blood. Every time he took a step, the very ground shook beneath his feet. Perhaps worst of all, every time he got hit, he just shrugged it off with a laugh. And what a laugh it was. It changed in pitch and cadence at random, but nevertheless clearly carried itself over the sound of bloodshed around it. It was at once malicious and psychotic, but also dreadfully innocent and mocking. It sounded almost like a mean-spirited boy bullying something far smaller and weaker than himself because he didn't know any better. Though the four-armed demon's appearance was certainly formidable and intimidating, it was nothing when compared to the nightmare-inducing terror that practically radiated from that thing. The underwear-soiling fear that seemed to overcome the humans whenever they looked at this intruder wasn't their own. Not entirely, at least. Much of it had been induced by the combination of the Butcher of Humanity perk and its newly acquired Despair Aura skill. The Empire trained its soldiers to recognize and resist mental attacks like this, but there was also the matter of the genuine terror one felt when seeing their comrades in arms slaughtered with such ease. It was a testament to the soldiers' courage and spirit that they didn't just instantly scatter in all directions. Of course, it wasn't just Boxy and Cora running wild. A slim, vaguely spider-shaped shadow moved across the chaotic battlefield, reaping the lives of humans with silent glee. Drea happily impaled, stabbed, dismembered, and took bites out of any soldiers she came across within her master's vicinity. She had no idea a noisy place like this could be to her liking, but it definitely was. The way Boxy's terror-inspiring presence demanded everyone's attention meant she was free to move around as she pleased. Some of those men didn't even realize those standing right next to them had been suddenly robbed of their lives, and the ones that did only sank deeper into despair. And as if to punctuate all of this, another meteor, the third one of the night, came crashing down on top of them. The resulting shockwave and flames quickly scattered the surrounding army, creating a lull in the battle. The prisoners, who silently watched the carnage unfold from the sidelines, shielded their eyes and faces as the wave of light and heat washed over them, their cages rattling from the impact. By the time they looked back at the masked intruder, he was the only one left standing amidst a sea of death, smoke, and flames. He looked straight at them, sending shivers down their spines. Much to their surprise, he didn't attack them, nor did he free them. He simply drank a few potions, resummoned the mostly dead fiend to replenish her strength, then disappeared. Several tense seconds passed before the sounds of carnage picked up once more from elsewhere in the camp.
Guys, I'm here!
It was at this point that a scantily clad beastkin appeared from the shadows. Lola's voice was silenced by the collar on her neck, but she still mouthed the words, "Kira, are you okay? What's going on?"
"I'm fine,"
the redhead replied without skipping a beat.
"And I don't know, but we need to get out of here."
She hurriedly unlocked their cages and bindings with a set of keys, then took charge of the 10 ex-prisoners. None of them complained as she guided them through the desolate portions of the camp. They ran into a few small pockets of Imperial troops, but used whatever weapons they managed to pick up off the ground to fight their way through. Thankfully, the humans were far too disorganized to pay them any real mind, allowing the adventurers to successfully flee into the wilderness of the clattering plains. It was still the dead of night without a hint of natural light, but the group figured they'd be fine so long as they kept that burning camp at their backs. It wasn't until about an hour and several kilometers later that the group finally stopped running and took stock of their situation. They were cold, hungry, tired, and in the open with absolutely no cover. But they were free. The adrenaline rush of their escape had long faded by now, leaving them with a vague sense of dread and unease. Most of them felt like throwing up when they thought back to that terrible bloodshed they'd witnessed. Even the normally stoic and fearless Lola found herself dry-heaving after her first real experience of warfare, though it was at least partially because she overexerted herself. Jules and a dwarven druid from another recon team had been slowing the group down, so she had taken it upon herself to carry both of them, one on each shoulder. The result was the abnormally athletic warrior driving herself to total physical exhaustion, with rivers of sweat pouring out of her entire body. Lola couldn't ask any questions during the frantic run, but now that she finally got a chance to catch her breath, questions were all she had. A lot of them were about Kira, such as how she had managed to escape her captors and what was in that weird bag she was carrying. Some were directed towards more general concerns, such as where they'd find food and whether they'd be able to make it back to base without their gear. However, looking at the distant glow of the still blazing camp at the edge of the plains, there was only one question that Lola could voice first.
"Who or what was that?"
"That, I believe,"
Kira smiled weakly,
"was the Sandman."
Part 4.
"Wait, you mean the Sandman?"
one of the male elves exclaimed.
"As in, the guy that single-handedly decimated Azurvale's criminal underworld?"
"Well, yeah. I mean, maybe. I don't know. Could be?"
Kira's wavering response did little to reassure the man.
"Look, I'm not sure if that's really the Sandman from the rumors,"
Lola butted in.
"But I've seen that guy before. We caught a glimpse of him a week ago when we were sent to clear out a group of bandits."
"What happened to those bandits?"
he asked her.
"Gone without a trace. Not even blood was left behind."
"And you're sure it's the same one?"
"Trust me, there's not a lot of guys taller than me. I'd almost think he was a demon or something if not for his lack of horns."
"Oh, right," Jules mumbled from the side. "I should probably summon my familiar now that I have the chance."
The warlock had put off doing so because of the danger involved. Standing perfectly still for 10 whole seconds in the middle of a war zone while concentric circles of light swirled around him seemed like an immensely stupid idea. But now that they were out of that damned camp and too far away for the light show to attract any unwanted attention, he wasted no more time in summoning his familiar. All eyes were on Purupururin when she materialized out of thin air. Dressed in high heels, lacy stockings, matching gloves, a fetishistic corset, and a positively tiny thong. As scandalous as that outfit was, the succubus was still the most modestly dressed person in the group. An absurd-sounding yet true fact that all of the adventurers seemed to realize at the same time.
"Oh, right!"
Kira exclaimed.
"I managed to find everyone's stuff."
She took the large leather bag strapped around her shoulder and began emptying its contents out on the ground. It turned out to be a high-class bag of holding that the humans were using to store the prisoners' confiscated belongings.
"You seriously went around looking for those?"
questioned the man from before.
"I know it was a stupid thing to do, but I couldn't just leave these behind."
She solemnly rubbed the three steel rings on her right hand.
"Besides,"
she added,
"I don't think we'll make it that far just in our underwear."
The group may have borrowed some weapons during their escape, but they'd been so focused on running away that none aside from Kira had even considered to look for anything else.
"I suppose it was the right call,"
Lola nodded.
"How did you break out, exactly?"
"Hmm? What are you saying, Lola?"
Kira replied with an aloof smile.
"We were together the entire time, weren't we? That mysterious stranger freed us, yes?"
"Huh? But you got carried off by..."
"We got freed. Together. Right?"
"Right."
It was painfully obvious she didn't want to talk about what had transpired after she was separated from the group. The others made grim expressions as they silently got dressed. They shared a few worried looks and wordlessly agreed not to touch that particular topic, at least for the moment.
"Say, that's weird," Jules spoke up. "I don't see my staff, or my rings for that matter."
His clothes, armor, cloak, and alchemical field kit were all there, but the mithril-tipped staff and enchanted jewelry were gone. Others also couldn't find whatever magical or valuable items had been taken from them.
"I don't know. Maybe they put the fancy stuff in a different bag or something?"
Kira shrugged. It certainly wasn't like some shiny obsessed monster stole those items specifically.
"More like the thieving bastards kept the expensive stuff for themselves,"
someone else complained. The rest readily agreed. This vitriolic assertion wasn't entirely caused by propaganda-fueled prejudice. Unlike soldiers, adventurers had to procure and provide for their own equipment, so having their most prized possessions wind up missing was a bitter pill to swallow.
"How come only your valuables were left behind?"
One of the other female rangers pointed at Kira.
"These rings are sentimental, you jackass,"
the redhead snapped at her.
"They're not magical. They just... Look, I know you're angry, but I grabbed what I could, okay?"
"Yeah, you're right. I'm sorry for saying that."
The ranger quickly apologized.
"It wasn't fair. Really, thank you for everything."
With that matter settled, everyone geared up. The group began the long trek back to base, unsure of what to think of the evening's events. Except for the two succubi in their midst. It went without saying that the one masquerading as Kira knew exactly what had transpired, seeing as she helped make it happen. Puru Pururin, on the other hand, had watched the boxy show with great interest while she was away. She couldn't help but be impressed at how masterfully her fellow succubus played her part as Kira. Then again, it was hardly surprising considering her heavy involvement in the development of the persona. Back on Boxy's side, it continued its indiscriminate rampage, and managed to slaughter around 700 of the Empire's soldiers before being forced to pull back. It would have gladly continued, but it was running out of steam. Even if Butcher of Humanity constantly replenished bits of its HP and MP, it didn't mean it could fight indefinitely. Still, it lasted much longer than it would have otherwise, and was genuinely thankful for having this perk for the first time in its life. As expected, the doppelganger job barely went up to level 22, despite having murdered a large number of people during the first phase of the attack. It once again reaffirmed that the job wasn't a battle-oriented one. That said, it wondered whether it should look into getting a job that focused on melee combat, hopefully one that could make use of as many of its varied attributes as possible. In any event, it had realized partway through the massacre that it was wasting valuable combat XP fighting the humans in close quarters and switched to using only spells and familiars. Thanks to that, it managed to advance its warlock job all the way up to level 47, giving it access to a tasty new skill. Soul Link. The warlock's demonic servants are made to share both the boons and burdens of life. Requirements: Level 45 Warlock, Demonology. Type: Sustained. Activation time: Instant. Cost: 10 MP per second. Range: 100 meters. Active effects: Transfers 30% of the damage taken by one familiar to all other familiars. Temporary effects bestowed upon one familiar will also be bestowed to all other familiars. Passive effects: Increases the HP of all summoned familiars by 3% per level of this skill. Reduces the MP cost of this skill by 50% at level 5 of this skill. Merges the telepathic links between the summoner and their familiars into a single channel. This skill had several potential applications, but they all equated to the same result. Its minions would be much harder to kill. It also allowed Boxy to use the relatively short-ranged Dark Infusion spell to power up all three of its familiars at once, as long as they were within the very generous 100-meter range of Soul Link. This would, in theory, also work with other strengthening effects, such as a priest's magical blessing or alchemical elixirs. However, it seemed likely this ability would also spread negative effects, such as the dark chains summoned by its Shadowbind spell. Boxy would need to experiment with the skill to determine its limits, but it didn't have the time for that at present. As for the merging of telepathic links into a single channel, it basically meant that all of the demons could now mind talk to one another and their master, which made communication easier. The monstrous warlock had also learned two new spells after rising to level 47. One was a ruin spell called Reality Slash, which allowed it to launch an invisible blade that did physical damage rather than magical. It seemed useful for cutting through anti-magic defenses, but was a lot less effective against armor. The other one was Mind Control, which did exactly what its name implied. Boxy already possessed the far superior Puppet Parasite skill, so that particular spell would probably never see much use. It honestly considered most of the domination spells at its disposal to be rather lacking and unreliable. Even Mass Panic spell crystals were obsolete, considering that the combination of Butcher of Humanity and Despair Aura had pretty much the same effect. It was a bit disappointing, but the shapeshifter didn't think it too big an issue since it hadn't gone out of its way to acquire those spells. This was unlike that fleet-footed ranger skill it was forced to pick up. The slight bonuses that ranger skill provided to its agility attribute were really all it was good for. The monster really didn't feel like picking it up, but it had little choice in the matter. Adventurer guilds had mandatory full appraisals every now and then, and essence concealment could only hide parts of its actual status, not show things that weren't there. Therefore, Fayhorn would eventually find out if Boxy only pretended to pick fleet-footed. Ignoring the old elf's sage advice was a very un-Kira-like thing to do, so it had already given up on the skill as a necessary sacrifice. While Boxy enjoyed the rewards of that imperial harvest, the group of 11 Republic escapees continued steadily making their way towards Fort Yimin. After skillfully establishing herself as the de facto leader, Zira volunteered to watch their backs while another ranger took the lead. It was unlikely any of the 8th Imperial Expeditionary Force would dare chase after them considering the losses Boxy had inflicted, but the escapees wouldn't know that. It was also the perfect excuse to allow the succubus and her master to stealthily swap places and outfits, while the others took a brief rest in the shade of one of the few hilt trees in the clattering plains. They reached Fort Yimin shortly before sundown, almost a full day after the rest of their allies. Unsurprisingly, their sudden and unexpected appearance caused a bit of an uproar. The higher-ups had more or less written them off as dead, and yet here they were, exhausted, starving, and thirsty, but most definitely alive. Their identities were confirmed through appraisal, after which they were taken in to be asked a bunch of questions. That was how Kira found herself in a tiny room of wood and stone. The walls were depressingly bare and dull, and the only furniture around was a small square table in the middle with two chairs on opposite ends. The catgirl sat in one, happily devouring the small plate of grilled meat in front of her. She wasn't quite sure what animal it came from, nor did she care. The superb taste of human flesh was still fresh in the back of her throat, so she focused on that vividly delicious memory as she thoughtlessly scarfed down whatever this meal was. At that point, Boxy began to consider the merits of learning how to preserve meat. Thoughts of human jerky, smoked liver, pickled hearts, and salted fingers passed through its mind, causing its appetite to flare up even more. Eating those things bloody raw was preferable, but there had been far too many bodies for it to devour in one go back in that fight. It had to regretfully leave most of them behind, and the 6 corpses it put inside its storage were going to start rotting pretty soon. Besides, cooking those tasty things with other moderately tasty things was bound to let them reach new pinnacles of tastiness, right? The monster therefore deemed that learning to cook was an endeavor worthy of its time. The cooking skill was a general skill that anyone could acquire and level up if they put the time and effort in, not unlike stealth or meditation. Boxy had no idea what exactly the skill did, but it knew it to be like a miniature and condensed version of the alchemist job. Since the shapeshifter thought it did a great job mixing up the ingredients required for the ritual of unholy wealth, it figured cooking couldn't be that difficult. Thinking on it some more, Boxy realized something. If cooking wasn't all that difficult, and anyone could learn the skill, then the shapeshifter didn't really need to do so personally. In fact, having someone else put the work in only for the selfish monster to reap the benefits sounded like a much tastier concept. Now, if only it knew someone gullible enough to waste their own time and effort for the sake of a man-eating murder box. Oh wait, it did. Boxy. Ambrosia, are you there? Ambrosia. Greetings, my lord. 'Tis good to hear thou art in good health. Boxy. Ah, yes, hello. Anyway, you can't cook, right? Ambrosia. 'Tis so, my lord. I get mine sustenance from the ground beneath mine roots and the sun above mine leaves, after all. Boxy. Can you learn to cook, then? For my sake? Ambrosia. It would be mine honor, nay, mine pleasure to master the culinary arts in thy name, my lord. Boxy. Very good. Just make sure you focus on meat-based recipes. Use the prisoners for ingredients. Ambrosia. Understood. I shall make sure to prepare a feast for thy triumphant return. Well, wasn't she enthusiastic? Boxy actually looked forward to the very capable dryad's results after hearing that. It had some doubts whether the dryad's tastes would line up with its own, or whether a sentient piece of vegetation was capable of tasting things in the first place. Still, it was hardly an issue. Worst-case scenario, it would just teach Ambrosia what sort of food it liked best and have her prepare it. That would have to wait until later, however. For now, it needed to focus on this tiny room it was locked in, as well as the people it sensed gathering outside the door. The door opened to reveal the grizzled face of Fayhorn, as well as the stern-looking communications officer Kira had been in touch with until recently. The veteran adventurer sat down opposite the catgirl, while the others stood at attention behind him.
Kira Morgana,
he said, with a dry voice. Kira swallowed her mouthful of meat loudly while breaking out into a cold sweat. His attitude was very reminiscent of how he behaved during her training. A few tense moments passed before a relieved smile floated onto her teacher's face.
It is good to see you're alive, kid.
Thank you, sir.
And I believe you already know Primus Silas Underwood from the FIB.
He gestured at the man behind him. He and Kira nodded to each other in greeting. Of course, Boxy was surprised when it heard the name Underwood during its briefing more than a week ago, as it had used that alias during its departure from the Empire. It quickly learned this was just a weird coincidence. The only reason it chose the name Chester Underwood back in Bootlick was because it thought of itself as a wood and chest that had gone under cover. It thought it was being clever at the time, but Snack kindly pointed out this was actually an idiotic name, so it picked something far less obvious for its next public persona. After exchanging greetings, Fayhorn began interviewing Kira regarding the events that had taken place since they last saw each other while Silas mostly stood and listened. The catgirl relayed a similar story as the rest of the escapees. Their team found themselves surrounded and surrendered as prisoners of war under Axel's protection, but not before shattering the comm crystal as instructed. They were then stripped of their belongings, locked up, and took the opportunity to escape when a mysterious figure raided the Imperial Army's camp. There was just one discrepancy that Fayhorn wanted to address.
So, you say you were freed by this Sandman character?
Yes.
I already know that's not what happened, Kira.
What do you mean?
Some of the others said you were taken away in the middle of the night by some men and came back looking disheveled.
The beastkin fell silent and looked down at her hands, avoiding her mentor's eyes.
Did they do anything to you while you were separated?
No.
You're absolutely sure nothing happened to you? Kira, don't make me fetch an interrogator. Ah, damn, I'm no good at this.
Allow me, sir.
Silas spoke up for the first time since coming into the room, then traded places with Fayhorn.
First of all, I apologize for Fayhorn's stern words. I want you to understand. You are here among friends, and you are not under any suspicion or in any sort of trouble.
The cat girl gave a small nod.
Now,
as good as it is to see you've made it back, we need to know where and how you obtained the documents you brought us.
He was referring to the present that Kira had brought back, a bunch of maps and letters that a rookie conscript like her would have no chance of understanding.
Is it okay if I ask you a few simple questions?
Sure. I mean, yes, sir.
She quickly corrected herself.
Very good. Now then, according to your dossier, you have decently developed lockpick and stealth skills. Is this correct?
Yes, sir.
And I am also led to believe that your claws can be quite dangerous when used properly.
Yes, sir.
Meaning, you use your natural born gifts and basic skills to break free of your bindings while your captors were otherwise distracted.
Yes, sir.
She repeated yet again. Fayhorn raised an eyebrow in admiration. He was honestly quite impressed at how tactfully Silas skirted the heavy topic that he failed to approach directly. It was quite clear that, judging from what he heard, the cat girl had been sexually assaulted during her imprisonment. While that both was and wasn't the case in reality, it was still the only conclusion he could reach. It was a sensitive issue that he clearly had no idea how to approach. He usually let his friend Lictor do the talking whenever things like this popped up. The paladin had always been the people person of Fayhorn's adventuring party, as he was a lot more tactful than the other two. Unfortunately, the angelic elf had been stationed somewhere else entirely, so the ranger couldn't rely on him this time around.
Why did you not escape immediately upon freeing yourself?
Underwood inquired.
Why take the extra risk to find the prisoner's belongings?
Because we wouldn't get far without them,
she answered curtly.
Facing the wilderness without the right tools is tantamount to suicide.
Her mood seemed to improve as she said that, as did Fayhorn's. He felt proud that this girl remembered his ramblings, even under those dire circumstances.
Did you run across these papers while searching for your equipment?
Silas continued.
Not exactly. I only just found our stuff when Sandman started making noise and the whole camp rose up in arms. I was desperately running from cover to cover, trying to stay hidden and too afraid of being found out, what with all those soldiers running around. I somehow stumbled upon this big tent with a bunch of important-looking charts and stuff. I figured they might be useful, so grabbed as many as I could and stuffed them in the bag while I had the chance.
I see. So that's how it was. Tell me, this Sandman character, do you know him?
No.
She shook her head.
We did meet, though, back in Azurvale. Well, not meet, but, you know.
You had an encounter.
Yeah, that.
All right. And what happened afterwards?
Well, some guards showed up and took me in, then gave me a stern talking to.
They did what?
Silas raised a curious eyebrow.
Yeah, I didn't get it either. I was the one that got mugged, yet I still felt like I was being arrested. It took forever before me and my, roommate were allowed to go home.
Fayhorn failed to stifle a chuckle while his colleague pinched his nose with a sigh.
I meant what happened after you got those papers, he clarified.
Oh, right. Sorry.
Kira apologized messily.
I followed after the path that guy opened up. He was just cutting his way through their camp, you know? He was super strong and really amazing. He had all these tough-looking demons and these flashy lights. Then these huge fiery rocks fell down and—
Underwood raised a hand to interrupt and calm down the overly enthusiastic cat girl.
And that's how you rejoined the others, did you?
Ah, yeah. That's right, sir.
Very good, Miss Morgana. That's all I need to hear from you.
The stern-looking elf stood up, leaned over the table, and whispered gently.
I know some excellent people that can help you deal with any and all emotional troubles you might have. I can point you to them if you ever feel the need to let something heavy off your chest.
I don't...
Remember, the wounds we can't see are often the deadliest. Best to get them treated immediately.
I see. Just a wound, is it? I think I'll do that then. Thanks, Mr. Underwood.
She said with a weak smile.
Think nothing of it, trooper, he answered with a faint smile. Now then, it's a bit sudden and informal, but we're in a bit of a rush, so please bear with me and step outside.
Yes, sir, right behind you.
Underwood's face tensed up once more as he stood upright with his hands behind his back. Kira and Fayhorn followed him out of the room and into the hallway, only to be met with over 30 people that seemed to be waiting for them, most of them adventurers. They were lined up on either side of the hallway and wearing their respective guild uniforms. Among the familiar faces were Kira's team members, Lola and Jules, as well as several other classmates and fellow adventurers she hadn't seen in a while. The other former prisoners were naturally present, and even Fizzy was there for some reason.
Legionnaire Kira Morgana of the Third Republic Legion's First Scouting Battalion.
Silas called out the cat girl's full rank and name, causing her and the others to stiffen up and stand at attention. The redhead tracked Underwood with her eyes as he walked up to her and stared at her intently. She didn't move a single muscle.
For your exemplary service to the Republic,
he said in a clear, commanding tone.
For showing outstanding bravery and ability in the face of adversity. For going above and beyond the call of duty. For risking life and limb to safeguard the lives of your fellow countrymen. You are hereby awarded the Golden Crescent.
The elf reached into his coat's inner pocket and took out a tiny black box. He opened it to reveal an award with a very literal name. It was an 8-centimeter-wide golden crescent. The medal was delicately engraved with various decorative patterns and the initials KM clearly stamped in the middle of it. Silas deftly pinned it to the right breast of Kira's green tunic with the edges pointed upward, almost as if it were a smile. Once he finished, he stood aside while the others applauded and cheered in a rather disorderly manner. Underwood waited for them to quiet down for several seconds before continuing.
For your meritorious deeds, firm decision-making under pressure, and commendable strategic thinking. You are also hereby promoted to the rank of Decanus,
he declared with a polite smile.
We expect great things from you, Miss Morgana. Now, take a good long rest and report to my office first thing in the morning the day after tomorrow for your next assignment.
Yes, sir. Thank you, sir.
Kira gave a genuinely enthusiastic response as applause and congratulations poured down on her once more. Of course, Boxy was happy. Granted, it wasn't quite sure what sort of significance this award had, but it was a uniquely shiny thing that made all that extra effort worth it. As for the Decanus thing, it simply meant Kira was now a non-commissioned officer in the Republic's military forces. It was roughly equivalent to the rank of sergeant in the Imperial Army, which gave her the authority to lead and command a squad of up to 10 soldiers. Not the most glorious of assignments, but still a monumental achievement for a 16-year-old rookie.
"People!"
Fayhorn shouted, causing the noisy atmosphere to grind to a complete halt.
"There's a time and place for celebration, you know."
The others looked at each other with difficult expressions, as if someone just farted in their salad.
"Which, by the way, is 30 minutes from now, and in the mess hall. Drinks are on me!"
The cheers resumed as the gathered rabble dragged the hero off to celebrate. Fayhorn watched them with a smile, while Silas maintained his serious expression. Once the rabble cleared off, the two veterans stepped back into the tiny, soundproofed interrogation room.
"She's clean,"
Silas immediately said.
"Well, she probably feels sullied after what happened, but she seemed genuine enough."
He'd lied through his teeth when he said Kira wasn't under suspicion earlier, although the brief chat blew most of his worries away.
"That's good."
Fayhorn sighed with relief.
"I'd hate to have to put her through any of the more rigorous interrogation, especially considering what she brought us."
The plans Kira brought back were still undergoing analysis, but they clearly showed the Imperials' aim to siege Fort Yemen within the week. This was much earlier than anticipated, and the forces they were sending were overwhelming.
"I just hope the poor kid isn't traumatized by the end of all this," said the worrywart of a ranger.
"Indeed. Well, that's why it's important to let her and the others make happy memories while they can."
Objectively speaking, their chances of holding the fort were next to nil. An ambush in the wilderness was one thing, but a siege was where soldiers had the definite edge over adventurers. The Empire's military completely outclassed the Republic's in every way that mattered, and the humans would bring quite a few powerful individuals of their own. At this point, the question wasn't whether the Third Republic Legion could hold Fort Yemen, but how much damage they'd be able to inflict on the enemy before they fell.
"This Sandman character worries me, though."
Fayhorn changed the subject.
"Just how is he related to all this?"
"I can't say. His motives, methods, and movements are all unclear at this point. However, like it or not, we do owe him."
Silas reached into his breast pocket and pulled out a torn, wrinkled, and slightly stained piece of paper.
"Literally,"
he stressed while passing it to Fayhorn.
"What's this?"
"Something that was dropped off in front of the gates earlier today. It was nailed to the dismembered head of one Lord Hayhurst, former commander of the 8th Imperial Expeditionary Force."
Fayhorn took the piece of paper and looked at it with ever-widening eyes.
"Is this a joke?"
"Do I look like I'm laughing?"
The ranger looked down at the note once again, both impressed and disgusted at the shamelessness of it all. Invoice: from Sandman Assassinations Incorporated, to whom it may concern, Third Republic Legion. Invoice number 000001. For services rendered: Imperial soldiers times 700, 7,000 GP. Commanding officer times 1, 1,000 GP. Next day delivery, 300 GP. Subtotal, 8,300 GP. Boxing tax, 5%. Total, 8,715 GP. Payment terms: to be received within 5 days. Tell the red cat-eared beastkin to drop it off at the 600-year-old hilt tree south of the fort. We appreciate your patronage and look forward to doing business with you again in due course. Chapter 5. Making Connections. Part 1. There was a sharp knock on the door to Silas Underwood's office. The man himself was already hard at work organizing the information from the stack of reports on his desk, despite it barely even being dawn. He hadn't slept the night before, though he certainly didn't let his fatigue show.
Enter!
He called out while scribbling on a document. The door swung open and the newly appointed junior officer walked in, announcing her presence with a salute.
Decanus Kira Morgana, reporting as instructed, sir.
It was an all-too-chipper voice that swept away the stale atmosphere of the messy office, making it the slightest bit more jovial. Her full-faced smile and gently swaying tail gave the impression of a person who had obtained true happiness. It was hard to believe this was that same frightened girl who seemed terrified of admitting she'd been allegedly violated just a few days ago.
Ah, yes. Please have a seat, Decanus. I'll be with you in a moment.
The beastkin did as instructed and seated herself in the chair on the opposite end of the desk. Silas continued working on his estimate of the casualties should the Empire's impending siege of Fort Yemen go unhindered, but his mind was elsewhere. He stealthily appraised and observed the catgirl out of the corner of his eye, watching every tiny mannerism, twitch, and idle motion. The reason for this scrutiny was that, in Underwood's opinion, she seemed far too happy considering her circumstances. Even though her behavior seemed odd and out of place at first glance, prior conversations with those close to her suggested this was actually normal for her. Her mood here at base supposedly swayed back and forth between gloomy and cheerful like a pendulum, to the point where one could call her volatile or unstable. Yet, out in the field, she displayed a surprisingly serious and calculating demeanor. It was as if there were several different people living in that head of hers. Granted, it would be difficult to find an adventurer who was playing with a full deck of cards, as it were, but the near-total lack of animosity in her was noteworthy. In fact, the only time she showed any genuine hostility was whenever the topic of the Empire's military came up. She seemed to hold some sort of grudge towards them, but it was important to note this was limited to their soldiers. She had no issue communicating or working with any human adventurers that sided with the Republic, which spoke favorably of her character in Underwood's personal opinion. Indiscriminately hating the many because of the actions of the few was the sort of thing that fanned the flames of this damned war to begin with. As for the girl's character, Silas was able to reach the painfully obvious conclusion that she was too easy to read. She didn't hide her feelings, and her thoughts floated onto her face without hesitation. There was already somewhat of a rumor within the barracks how bad of a gambler she was. Her bluffing skills were so bad that some of the soldiers actually felt bad for taking her wages whenever they played cards. At least three of them had gone on record stating that it felt like bullying, especially since the girl kept blaming her losses on her own inadequacies. Long story short, Kira's currently fluffy state of mind was most likely caused by something that had happened very recently.
You seem to be in a good mood,
said Silas after putting away the report.
Hmm? Ah, yes, that is, I just got a letter from home, you see.
Good news, I trust.
That's one way to put it,
she declared with a goofy grin. The letter was from an individual called Rowana Slythe. It had actually arrived the day before, but Underwood used his authority to delay its delivery to read it for himself. The colorful language made it clear that she and Kira were more than just roommates, and honestly made the elf uncomfortable. Spying on his subordinates like that may have been a necessary thing in his line of work, but that didn't mean he liked it. At least the invasion of privacy had been helpful. Knowing that Kira was in a romantic relationship made it easy to understand why she hesitated to speak of what transpired two nights ago. She was probably trying her best to purge the unpleasant memories from her mind. Well, that was possible in the literal sense with the help of a psionic, but that was a rather extreme measure. Whether or not she actually visited those mental specialists Underwood mentioned during her debriefing was up to her, though it was unlikely she'd get the chance to while the war was going on. It was unfortunate, but her mental health was a relatively minor thing when compared to the sort of issues Silas was currently struggling with.
Now then, I must discuss a very sensitive matter with you. What I'm about to tell you is strictly on a need-to-know basis. You are not to speak of it to anyone outside this room unless I personally tell you to. Understood?
Yes, sir.
Kira's giddy demeanor disappeared, replaced with a more serious one as she saluted while puffing out her chest. The sharp movement made her new metal glint pointedly. The Golden Crescent was a relatively common award given out to distinguished individuals and was ultimately nothing more than a fancy trinket, but she clearly wore it with pride. Silas, for his part, was glad she earnestly accepted the gesture for what it was.
"What do you make of this, Decanus?"
Silas reached into a desk drawer and took out the invoice that he had received several hours before the Catgirl's triumphant return and slid it across the desk. Kira picked it up, and her expression went from surprised, to curious, to grim, then downright shocked as she scanned it top to bottom.
"This? Is this a prank?"
she asked with an incredulous voice.
"I said this was a serious matter, did I not?" he repeated sternly.
Yes, sir. Sorry, sir."
Her initial reaction had been more or less the same as everyone else's who had seen that ridiculous scrap of paper, so Silas couldn't really fault her for it.
"But still, a prank? What makes you say that?"
"Well, even if you ask me that, I don't even know where to start, sir."
"Then start at the first thing that caught your attention."
"Yes, sir. It feels weird for the Sandman to ask for money. Isn't he an ally of justice?"
"You know, that would technically make him our enemy, right?"
"Eh?"
"The Empire claims Teresa herself is on their side, you know."
"Oh, right."
Even if Teresa's devoted most certainly took part in the war, whether the Goddess of Truth and Justice personally supported it was another question entirely. Mere mortals could not hope to comprehend the will of the gods, but it was already public knowledge that Teresa's hero was slated to take part in the conflict. That aside, the concept of justice relied entirely on one's perceptions and preconceptions. The virtue was a matter of perspective that could change at a moment's notice. Silas was not a man who could trust in something as vague and fallible as that.
"To be frank, I'd be far more relaxed if this invoice was the real deal," he admitted. "A motivation of wanting to make money is something I find easier to believe in than altruism."
Of course, one needed to be wary of loyalty bought with coin. That wasn't to say mercenaries and sellswords were untrustworthy. It all depended on how professional they were, and whether or not they abandoned their contracts when it suited them. This was the kind of common sense the pragmatic Boxy expected the elves' higher-ups to employ. However, Kira was supposed to be a young, idealistic girl. Therefore, it made sure to show a troubled and uncomfortable expression at the elf's words.
"So then, this is the assignment you mentioned, sir?"
"That's right. Although I do wonder why he singled you out. Do you have any idea why he would do that, Decanus?"
The shapeshifter had named itself Courier so that it would know in advance what sort of funny business the elves would try to pull during the handoff. It was also a question of whether they would pay willingly, but then it would just take what it was owed through brute force. Should that happen, the stingy elves would only have themselves to blame. Besides, even if they were short on military personnel, it wasn't like the Republic's coffers were light. The shapeshifter was quite sure they'd have no trouble preparing the requested funds on short notice. It obviously wasn't going to admit that, so it prepared a few answers to the very obvious question the officer asked.
"Maybe he feels I won't betray him?"
Kira offered.
"And what makes you say that?"
"I do owe him my life, sir. Twice, actually."
"Yes, I suppose that's true."
It was also not really a question as to how or why she caught the Sandman's eye. Not only had the two met practically face-to-face back in Azurvale, but she stood out entirely too much. She was the only beastkin in the Third Legion, and her fiery red hair, ears, and tail demanded one's attention. Even the opposing force had no trouble singling her out after her capture. Her ability and potential were also outstanding, as evidenced not only by her results, but by how Fayhorn himself gave her special, almost preferential treatment. The last few days had more or less convinced Underwood her motivations to fend off the Empire's invasion was no less genuine than his own. It was her loyalty to the Republic itself that was still in question.
"What if I were to order you to betray him, though?"
he proposed. Her face once again became deeply troubled. showing she was unsure as to what to answer. As expected, she was conflicted. Although Silas was curious whether her gratitude towards her savior or her duty towards her country was stronger, this was not the time for such a pointless test.
Relax. It was a hypothetical question. No offense, but I don't expect an earnest person like you to be able to follow an order like that, even if you wanted to.
Thank you?
In any event, get your gear and get ready to depart within the hour.
So, we're actually going to hand over this much money? Just like that?
Her reaction was understandable. Nearly 9,000 gold pieces was quite literally a fortune. It was the sort of lump sum that could potentially set one up for life, if it was invested wisely. Either that, or it would at the very least allow an adventurer to retire a decade or two early. Silas chuckled dryly.
Believe it or not, his rates are actually very generous. Waging war is quite expensive.
Indeed, from a purely logistical standpoint, the average Imperial soldier was worth 30 to 50 times more than the 10 GP the Sandman charged for each of them.
Besides, the officer continued, it is my personal and official opinion that we want to establish good relations with this entity, which is why we'll give him a little gift to go along with the payoff.
Understood, sir. Still, I feel uneasy carrying that much money by myself.
Who said you're going by yourself?
Huh?
Nothing in the invoice said you had to go out there alone, so I'm sending you along with an armed escort, as well as one of our resident VIPs as insurance.
Boxy silently cursed its lack of foresight. This would complicate things, but it was fairly certain it could improvise something later. Right now, it needed to focus on the conversation.
They'll be there to back you up in case this is some sort of scam or trap. If that turns out to be the case, you are to abandon the money and retreat. The lives of my subordinates are more important than some coins and gems. Do I make myself clear?
Yes, sir. Thank you, sir.
The beastkin saluted.
Very good. Now, do you have any questions?
Just one. What is this boxing tack supposed to be? Is this a real thing?
Of course, the creature was aware of the answer. While the reasonable rates were something it discussed with Snack, the boxing tax had been suggested by Arms. Although she probably meant it as a bad joke, Boxy liked the sound of it and added it anyway. However, it would be un-Kira-like if it didn't ask about obvious things like this. Besides, it was genuinely curious how the elves would interpret it.
I suppose that's the shipping and handling charge.
Underwood said with a humorless smile.
Shipping and handling, sir?
The invoice was delivered in a wooden box, along with the enemy commander's severed head.
I see.
Though it ordered Claws to deliver said head, this was the first it heard of it being packaged. Where and how did that stalker even find a box in the first place?
Anything else?
Not at the moment, sir.
Good. This concludes your briefing. Dismissed, Decanus.
Yes, sir.
Kira stood up with another salute and exited the office while Underwood went back to his duties. Half an hour later, she was fully geared up and went to meet up with her armed escort, a platoon made up of 50 of the garrison's veteran soldiers. One could easily tell them apart from the conscripted adventurers due to their gear. Although each individual wore something befitting their job, light chainmail and padded armor for the scouts, thick cloaks and robes for the magic users, and metal-plated armor for the vanguards, they all had a uniform feel to it. Their matching appearance was primarily due to the predominantly silver-like color of their equipment and the eagle-wing-themed decorations and engravings along their shoulders and headgear. Among them was the VIP that Underwood mentioned, someone that had ranked up from a regular elf into a high elf. She was an older woman, much like the various guild instructors, except that her face was still beautiful, elegant, and smooth, with very few wrinkles. She had pure white skin that contrasted her long, raven-black hair and eyes. She was clothed in a luxurious black robe that seemed more like an evening gown than an adventurer's attire. It looked as if someone had cut out diamond-shaped holes out of the fabric, exposing her navel, collarbone, shoulders, the sides of her thighs, and her upper back to the world. It was a high-class magic item, without a doubt, but it also made it clear this woman put too much stock into appearances.
"Greetings, child,"
she said with a flourish of her arms.
"Know that you are in the presence of Emeril of the Maleficium. Fret not, for I shall guard your fragile existence without fail. All who seek to stand in our way shall be crushed under my heel."
Her tone and attitude were condescending, to say the least. It was obvious she looked down on everyone around her as if they were dead weight. The soldiers around her merely rolled their eyes within their helmets, suggesting they were already familiar with her prideful behavior. Her arrogance was somewhat justified, however, as Boxy had already caught wind of her reputation and her apparent expertise with lightning magic. She could effortlessly trounce the shapeshifter if it revealed itself, so it had to make extra sure its act was flawless.
"Hi, I'm Kira. I'll be in your care."
The woman called Emeril was stunned silent by the catgirl's excessively casual tone.
"Wow, so you're a high elf like Mr. Fayhorn, huh? I was expecting..."